Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
It's Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network, and I'm your host, Kathy Irway, and we're here, as usual, at Roberta's Pizza, the home of Heritage Radio. We've got a really good one today. I'm holding a book right now, and most people, when you hear the word soul food or soul cooking, might not normally think of Japanese food, but what do the Japanese think of when they think of soul cooking? That is the subject of the book I'm holding right now. It's called Japanese Soul Cooking, Ramen, Tonkatsu, Tempura, and More from the Streets and Kitchens of Tokyo and Beyond. The authors are Tadashi Ono. He is a chef Maison O.
Yes.
And also formerly Matsuri.
Yes.
And we've got Haris Salat. He is a they're both co-authors of this book, and he is also the owner of Ganzo in Brooklyn.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy restaurant and book writing lives to be here.
We own restaurants. We just drink all day. We're not that busy.
This will be fun. Yeah. Thanks for having us.
All right, well, you can help yourself. There's a bar right here.
Excellent. Yeah.
And this is your third cookbook together, because you've also written Japanese Hot Pots and the Japanese Grill.
That's right.
Right.
This is a great book. And what made you think of the concept, other than how delicious the food is? But the idea of Japanese soul cooking, I think, like, I don't even think I've heard that term coined before. Is it something that you guys sort of wanted to identify?
Yeah, I mean, we both love this cooking. And yeah. I think that in the greater, you know, world outside Japan, people have certain reference points for Japanese cuisine, whether it's sushi or the hallowed kaiseki meal, which is many plates that, you know, follow this very, this procession.
Izakaya
cooking, small plates. Yeah. So, I would say that kaiseki and sushi are actually very small parts of Japanese cuisine in Japan. Right. Izakaya is pretty popular. But the food that we talk about is what people really eat and crave a lot over there, and Tadashi eats and craves.
This is the food we eat every day. This is the food I grew up with, too. So
that's great.
Yeah, it's very accessible, fun, fitting also.
It is absolutely irresistibly delicious, right. Like everything in this book. So
yeah, and that's, that's what... You know, soul cooking should be, right? Mm-hmm. You know, just stuff that's like, you know, kind of like, you know, things that you really dig and that are easy to make and satisfying and hearty.
They're hearty. One thing I found really fascinating was how a lot of these dishes sort of started in a restaurant setting, but then evolved and now home cooks make it all the time, which is an interesting kind of evolution. Tadashi, since you grew up in Tokyo, was this something that you encountered, like your mom would make, or
yeah,
you would make?
Yeah, my mom always make a good curry.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, sometimes we don't make really ramen. Ramen's more restaurant food, but, they do deliver. So,
I just want to note that in delivery in Japan is actually the real tableware, like the real bowl. Did you have that? And then they come with a tray and everything. It's funny. It's
like
not plastic.
It's really ready to eat, like a home, you know. So that was a good thing.
Do you get to keep the bowls? And
no, they come pick it up later on. But
people,
sometimes they forget, so we have the bowl in the house. Oh,
bowls are you talking about?
Yeah,
they forgot, quote unquote.
Yeah. it's got a name on the bowl, too. So, this came from where?
I broke it, sorry. Right. Oh, that's great. No, but this is, I love how you have a history for each of these dishes, and it sounds like a lot of them were really amazing, like unique interpretations of dishes found afar. So, for example, you mentioned the curry.
Yeah, I mean, I think that like on a overall idea behind this book, which would really surprise us, and Tadashi and I talk about this because we both didn't expect this to be so interesting from a historical perspective. Mm-hmm. We thought we'd find out, I guess, in the sense that there's a bigger kind of picture that was drawn by this cooking, actually, and it is kind of down to earth cooking, but so I don't want to sound like, you know, too high concept here.
Yeah,
but there was a profound change in Japanese culture in the late 19th century when Westerners came to Japan after hundreds of years of the country being isolated. And, you know, Westerners brought, and also people from other parts of Asia brought the foods that they ate, which were meat and,
right,
you know, meat. And when you're talking about curry, which was actually a British import, not an Indian one, as we would think, mm-hmm. and it came in the form of curry powder, and it came through the British military, the British Navy, and so in Japan, it was considered this thing that came from England, you know, a British curry powder. So then people encountered these ingredients. And I, you know, you mentioned earlier about the restaurants. I think restaurants were one way that the, you know, people started cooking with this stuff. But it quickly spread throughout the country, too, into home kitchens. So everything that we have in our book, you know, with the exception, I'd say, of ramen, which is generally something you just go out to eat. But we wanted to do that because I know people in our, you know, audience would love to know how to make ramen
exactly,
at home.
Yeah. Right.
But, you know, even gyoza or okonomiyaki or
tonkatsu.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
In the house. Mm-hmm.
Very popular at home. And you can go out to a restaurant to have it. Yeah, all the donburi, right. Mm-hmm. All the, which are bowls of rice with food on top of it, which is such a different idea than typical Japanese cooking where a bowl of rice is served on the side. So, mm-hmm. you know, all these things filtered into the home.
It's fascinating. And I love how in the introduction you talk about this one turning point in history. It was also the late 19th century when the emperor of Japan decided to encourage meat eating.
Yeah, I mean.
And that just opened the floodgate of foods, it sounds like, from there.
Yeah, I mean, I've been trying to think of like what. It must have been so shocking in Japan, don't you think, Tadashi, at that point? Like,
oh, where, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know.
600 years they haven't eaten
meat. 1,000 years.
Yeah, 1,000 years.
And
yeah.
It was actually right. banned, right?
Right, it was taboo.
Yeah, taboo.
You know? For Buddhists, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Buddhism, gaming.
Tradition.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And then suddenly the emperor saw these giant, basically he saw these giant Westerners. And you got to remember that at that time, meat was considered health food, okay? Forget tempeh. Hey, yeah. I'm sorry, people, but you know, like if you didn't eat meat, in fact, from what we read, like when the Westerners came to Japan, they're like, what's with these people? They don't eat meat. How could they even, you know, be alive or stand up, you know, and actually make it up a staircase? So it was, you know, this belief that meat was really important uh-huh. for your diet. And at the same time, like the Westerners towered over the people that when they came to Japan.
Just
so the emperor.
Physicals.
Yeah. So the emperor is like, you know, I want my soldiers to look like that. So he, that's right. I mean, he actually ate meat in public and it sent a shockwave through the culture. I don't know what the corollary is in America, but it would be something completely unexpected.
It's like a cultural revolution almost.
Yeah.
Like, you know,
yeah.
Because food really influences a lot about culture and how you cook it at home, but also how you feel too and how you end up looking.
I mean, the one thing I'd say about, you know, Japan doesn't exist in a duality like Western civilization, right? So this kind of new, it's like Shintoism and Buddhism can coexist in the same plane in Japan. And the same thing that like this kind of eating and traditional washoku, traditional Japanese cooking,
still
never went away.
On,
yeah, exactly.
Still
in the home, too.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
So I'm sure you had miso soup.
Right.
And day. Curry, you know, and yes. You still have miso soup every day. I know you.
In the morning.
Right. You know, and so it didn't supplant one, or one wasn't better than the other. I mean, this, you know, but it became another layer that was that became part of the everyday life in Japan and all these dishes, which was really cool.
They are so good to adapt it, you know, adapt it and make it into something more like Japanese rather than just totally
and
Western
totally
cooking.
Interesting and
yeah.
different. Yeah,
right.
Because even if we talk about curry, just for example, like, you know, what we found is that the curry that came to Japan was very loose because the British would sop up with a piece of bread.
Mm-hmm.
But in Japan, you eat with rice, so you need a thicker product for people to be able to eat it with rice. So, I'm sorry, I just used the word product. I got to get out of the restaurant. But it's ridiculous. So it's the food, not product. But the curry was thicker.
Mm-hmm.
So you could easily eat it with rice.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's very tasty, too. I couldn't help but wondering while reading this, and maybe, Tadashi, you might know from your experience, but were there, like, a lot of, like, old ladies or, like, just people also who were more purists and didn't really get into this more kind of foreign-fangled food trends?
I don't know nowadays, but it used to be that way, too.
Yeah.
You know, like, older
people
never touch these food. Well, that could happen. That was happening. But right now, I think this food can be more popular than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just starting to become really like mainstream of Japanese cooking.
Yeah. It's all about balance. You mentioned washoku, the really like traditional Japanese home cooking, like miso soup.
Right.
And you said you guys would eat both of it.
But
it seems very different. Just, you know, like no meat. It's just, there's a lot of differences in
the
whole.
Well, it's more diverse, you know, like now.
Right, true.
Meat, of course, there is a traditional Japanese food that still exists and very strong.
Mm-hmm.
But this eating meat is like eating very irresistible, you know. It's like it gives such energy and all that.
Yeah.
Right? So I think naturally people adapted and just came into more like their blood and meat. You know?
I have to say, Tadashi, you're pretty tall, too. You definitely
I ate this food
changed.
All the time. That's why.
Tadashi never ate meat his entire life. He's a vegan.
I love meat.
Here's the secret. Yeah.
That's so funny. What is your favorite dish, if you have one, in the whole book? I don't know if that changes day to day or...
Go ahead.
I don't know, Tadashi.
Well, I love curry. I do love curry. I grew up with it. And every time when I grew up, if I hear tonight is a curry, I get so excited.
Oh.
I don't know what it is, but it gives you some kind of high, like a sugar high. I think it's the whole mixture of the spice gives you some kind of a highness, I think. So I just love curry.
And now, is it taboo to use the golden curry cubes?
No, you know? It doesn't matter.
No, it's okay.
I mean, you know, yeah, just every home has a different curry recipe.
Yeah,
right?
And then different powders.
There's some people like this cube, some people like this powder. You know, it's all kinds of
variation.
I mean,
we wanted to give in the book, we wanted to show people how you can make curry just from scratch.
Right.
You know, you know, and that's a great way to make curry. But it is true that in, you know, across Japan, I would say a very small percentage of people are making curry from scratch. You know, a lot of people are using the
golden curry.
They call it curry roux. And it's actually, golden curry, Vermont curry. It has all these crazy names. I'm like, what are you talking about?
Well, that's an interesting word for curry roux,
Yeah, and that's what it is. And so you throw those cubes in. And when you do that, of course, it's processed and it's got all kinds of stuff in it, you know, as opposed to making it from scratch. But, you know, in the bigger scheme of things, it's very convenient. And the great thing about curry is that you could throw anything in it. So you can have vegetables, you can have chicken and or pork, right? And like a basis of it is root vegetables, which are a really big part of Japanese cooking, and it's something that's very healthy and good for you. So, you know, everything's a balance, and they're great. You know, they're great for just whipping up curry fast.
That sounds perfect for this winter season right now.
Exactly.
Root vegetable curry. All right,
it's really good.
Yeah. Thanks so much. We're just going to have a quick little musical interlude, and we'll be right back chatting more.
You are listening to When It Was Wrong by the California Honey Drops on the Heritage Radio Network.org.
Well, I remember, baby. Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. You know, there's no more telling aspect, no more revealing virtue of a group of people having evolved in a lovely way than how they feed themselves, how they entertain, how they put food on the table, what they put on the table. Heritage Radio Network provides the clearest evidence that there's hope for us yet. Heritage Radio's like Fairway Market in that we both care deeply about what you're having for dinner tonight. Heritage Radio Network is not just about food, though. Every time I tune in, I learn something about things other than food, too. Architecture, design, stuff like that. But from where I stand, I still say, if you can't eat it, what's the point? For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
All right, we're back chatting with the authors of Japanese Soul Cooking, an absolutely delicious book by Tadashi Ono and Harris Salat. So they are both restaurant owners as well as co-authors of three cookbooks now together. So how does your cookbook writing factor into your restaurant's menu?
We do it, into our restaurants. I was going to say we write really fast.
Oh. Wait, what did you think I was going to say? How does it factor
in? Into the restaurant, you know, into us doing restaurants or being involved in restaurants.
Yeah, no. But does the food reflect your styles currently?
Well, I would say I take the lead on the food from Tadashi, mm-hmm. you know, but I love what Tadashi cooks in any respect. So, and we know each other for a long time. Your pizza needs a little work.
Yeah, I know.
Otherwise, you know, you're spot
new
on.
New thing.
Yeah. But
because Tadashi has been cooking for quite a while.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
And all kinds
chef.
Of cuisines,
right?
Actually, not just Japanese. So Tadashi has an amazing range. I'm going to talk about you in the third person. But but actually, your book does influence. You know, like your cooking. In the books that we put together, gets me thinking a lot about what we do at the restaurant that I run.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely, at Gonzo. So, you know, because we are what we're trying to do is create something that is kind of comfort food, and ramen is the center point
cozy,
of what we do.
Yeah.
So, and also do stuff. You know, even with our ramen, we're making stocks every day and working on making the tare, the flavoring base, and. You know, so we're trying to do everything from scratch with our ramen. And mm-hmm. We don't make our noodles, but our noodles are custom made for us by a noodle factory in Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's a strike against. But mm-hmm. but seriously, it, you know, so it does kind of follow a lot of what we think about when we write the cookbooks.
Awesome.
Well, Harris has
you?
A lot of passion uh-huh. about Japanese cooking. And also he come up with all kind of idea that, you know, it's going to be good and interesting
yeah.
for the people here. And he always asked me, what should we do? What should we do for this? And maybe we should do a cooking book to introduce more Japanese food to this audience.
Mm-hmm.
And he drives me crazy. But he come up with a great idea. You know?
Yeah.
So then you know, we both tried to execute it. And he's got such a drive. And mm-hmm. passion of it, so it does everything. I know cooking a little bit, but you know, if there is no drive for that, this book wouldn't come out.
Yeah.
And, I'm very thankful for this guy.
It's a two-way street. We're gonna now. excuse me. We're gonna take a moment to cry and hug. Excuse us for a second.
No, I haven't hugged wife for a long time.
So. Do what you gotta do. We're all
exactly.
friends here.
Unheard. Good.
Aw. No, really. This book is really a testament to the teamwork too, because I really enjoy the history, learning about it. And were you saying before that it was kind of like you found out more as you were doing this?
Yeah.
That some things were surprising?
Actually, Tadashi, you really, like, you know, you put on your historian hat, man. You would come up with all this stuff that you were digging up, because very little is available in English. So Tadashi's, you know, surfing around, looking for stuff, digging up information. And, you know, when you write a cookbook, and what we strive to do, because this is a, you know, if you look at cookbooks from different countries, actually have different ways of writing cookbooks.
Yeah.
So an American or North American, hi, our friends in Canada, but shout out. But there is typically a headnote
yeah.
that introduces a recipe and then this written recipe, right? And so, you know, I personally hate head notes that are all like, oh, man, that was so good and whatever. Like, so, yeah. You know, so we have this book and we're thinking about what do we say that's interesting and can leave something with the reader. You know, and of course, there's practical information. Be careful not to burn this or, you know, watch this carefully because that's what a head note does, too. But we started to try to think about, okay, what can we talk about? And once you started to dig into this, you found so much unbelievable information and so crazy, these stories, you mm-hmm. know. So we just started to really have a lot of fun and look deeper and think about it and discuss it. And that's where we were able to put in so much information that, you know, it's, look, writing is a way to learn something, and writing is always surprising. You know, that's why I enjoy doing it. You know, and Tadashi and I, you know, if I could speak for Tadashi, we like, you know, enjoy writing cookbooks because we, you know, we work on this stuff, and then it starts to, you know, things start popping out.
We like to know more.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then we can share. That'll be even better, right?
Yeah. You know, like, for example, I love how you figured out the name of the chef who invented certain batters for, was it?
Right.
Maybe that was the panko, the tonkatsu.
Right.
And then he also, I forget. He discovered something else.
What was the name of that guy from the Ginza? That's the guy who discovered.
Oh, the Rengate.
Yeah, Rengate guy.
Is the name of the restaurant. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
He was really inventive, that guy.
And then there was a Sichuan chef who was in opened a restaurant in Tokyo who introduced the Mapo tofu dish to Japan, and it's so popular now.
Very popular.
Yeah.
Very popular.
Actually, this guy and his son, who was on the Iron Chef, right, Tadashi?
Right, right.
These two guys were responsible for introducing a huge amount of Chinese cooking into Japanese culture.
Abe chili is one of the...
Well, one thing I thought was really interesting, that there's, you know, the gyoza and also ramen in general are... Right.
The Chinese dishes.
They're Chinese dish. Yeah. But they
especially
have such a
this guy
style.
Introduced a dish called Abe... shrimp with chili sauce, which uses ketchup.
Yeah.
So it's not really Chinese, it's not really Japanese, but it, you know, it, ketchup is American product, right?
The ketchup, yeah, was that
but
by way of American?
But I make it into something Chinese-Japanese, in a way.
But so, yes, I think you're probably right. It was probably because of the American occupation. There were also then the introduction of all these American
timing
things, like, but there's also like spaghetti came.
Hot dogs.
Yeah,
right.
Wiener.
Kielbasa. Kielbasa pasta. Right?
There we go. Oh, that's actually good.
Napolitan.
Right, that's Napolitan.
And then the okonomiyaki, I didn't realize that there are so many different versions in every region that are wildly elaborate, too. You have a step-by-step instruction on how to make one that it has like 8 layers.
Oh, it's insane.
It's insane.
It's almost like pizza. You can put anything you want to.
That's
you
true,
know, some
yeah.
people put oyster, you know,
it's not
people
just a
with clam,
it's
you
a
know.
Topping, too.
Yeah, it's a topping.
So tell topping me business, about this Hiroshima okonomiyaki. It has noodles in it? Is this really how it works?
It does have a noodle.
And yakisoba.
It's like a triple-decker sandwich or something.
It is.
It's really big.
So if I understand correctly, this sort of evolved from just like the most simple of basic rustic cooking, which is throw some veggies in batter and flip it, maybe a little egg.
Right.
And then it just went
not only
crazy.
Simple, but stuff that, you know, is very
cheap.
Economical. Yeah.
It is. Yeah. It's a lot of starch.
Sort of like a Korean pancake, right? A pajun.
Similar. Probably
scallion
pancake. The idea, because the okonomiyaki became big in western part of Japan, which is Osaka. Mm-hmm. Osaka has a lot of Korean population, too.
Oh, okay.
So it might have something to do with Korean culture, too, in a way, pajun or pindetak type of thing.
But then again, like that brilliant just elaboration that is added to this once very simple dish is really amazing.
Right.
Yeah, and it's funny, too, because there are certainly in Osaka and Hiroshima and all in that part of Japan, okonomiyaki restaurants where you go, you sit down, and they have these like flat tops, and people are making, these pancakes. But people do this at home too, because you can buy like an electric flat top, little teppan, a grill, and you could just have like a little okonomiyaki party at home, which is great.
That must be fun.
Yeah, it's so much fun. Yeah, we talked about it in skillets because we just wanted to figure out how to cook it in America.
Cast iron.
Yeah. Well, that's a that's the best for that. So, but it is really cool when you go to you know, homes and
these parties. Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. One thing it's funny that Japanese people likes to do things together. You know, like not only one guy just cooks. Okonomiyaki, you know, there's a part, okay, I shredded the cabbage, right? you cook this and you flap this and this guy, you know, turns around and all kind of,
you have like an assembly line.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, you know, we have a cookbook called Japanese Hot Pot.
Okay,
The second title is like, let's do hot pot. Uh-huh. Not like let's eat or let's make hot pot. Let's just do it together type of thing. So it's very, you know, funny thing.
But that sounds how really fun. I want to do that.
Yeah, very social.
Yeah, at my next party.
Yeah. It's great, actually.
Yeah. Put an electric skillet in the center of the room.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing we talk about gyoza, too, because I love gyoza, but it's, like, fun just to get people around and folding it, you know, and you could freeze extra ones or do stuff like that, but a lot of this cooking can be very social as well, and it's kind of the beauty of it.
So do either of you go to Japan often just to kind of check out what's there? Keep abreast. Eat a lot.
We've been going to Japan together, and we took our photographer last time, which we should have written a book about. But the but we had fun. But the I think we both go to Japan pretty regularly.
Regularly, yeah. So like a few times a year, even.
Now it's like once a year.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
You know, check That's in. Fun. But it is good because it's interesting because you see stuff in Japan, and especially for what we're doing now too, and it gets you thinking about, okay, you know, this is more restaurant stuff, but like how do you look at foods and what translates for an American audience, you know, and what could you introduce and surprise people and think that they would really dig.
Keep ideas going.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes I find, you know, that I think some folks think about Japanese or any other cuisine as kind of like this, it's stopped, right? It's like in this box. But in Japan, I mean, it's constantly, like any cuisine, it's a live thing. New ingredients, new stuff going in, you know, and people are cooking different things that are, to me, very Japanese. But, you know, maybe it has avocado or something different, you know, and it's you know, so it's great to check that out when we go to Japan.
It's good to go with him because sometimes I think I don't find anything interesting because it's so used to it.
Mm.
But, you know, different, you know, perspective. And I can dig out something very interesting for the audience here, too. So it's
so neat. Maybe, Tadashi, we should put on eBay, like, come to Japan with us and we'll have a an auction.
I thought that would be really fun.
Next thing. Right, exactly. And people will run for their lives afterwards.
Yeah. No, that they would come. That would be really fun. Well, that's about all the time we have for today. But just curious, since this is your third cookbook, do you have any plans immediately to write another one?
Well, you know, we were just having lunch here at Roberta's. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we were just talking about this, right, as a matter of fact, that maybe, you know, in the next year or so, it would be great to do a cookbook about traditional Japanese cooking, but how people eat it every, you know, again, from the way we take it, which is not this, you know, you have to speak in a hushed tone or all this other business, but just kind of like, how do you make that part of your life?
Not high end.
Right.
Not kind of,
right. No. And no, exactly. But
like a more regional country.
Yeah, because it's simple.
Real food.
Yeah.
Of but Japan. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Because it's a simplicity that you can learn. And once you get a couple of ideas, it's like Italian, really good Italian cooking is super simple, but you have to have your head wrapped around like what you're talking about, you know? And I think we could do the, you know, we want to do the same thing with Japanese. We just have to carve out a little more time.
And, that's so exciting.
So maybe that's the next thing.
Excellent. Well, best of luck with that. And thank you so much for sharing and taking the time to be on the show. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Definitely check out Japanese Soul Cooking. It's out from 10 Speed Press. And thanks everyone at Heritage. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.